This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your true goy. Would you please give us a haircut? Of music, news, and criticism, I'm your host, John Garamonica.
Three, that's a magic number. Yes, three. It is. It's the magic number. Three. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community.
No dilly-dallying, no dawdling. Questlove is here.
Hey.
Jazzbo is here.
You have to explain that one though.
That's fine. We'll do it. We'll do it on the backside. Everybody's getting their old names today. JD, the best kept secret, is hosting.
Well, then you're not Questlove. Your brother Question.
Yeah, I might be a sample.
This is everybody's got to go with what how they refer to themselves in 1989 for this episode.
I'm a sample.
Okay. We are here to talk De La Soul. At the top, that was the magic number from 3 Feet High and Rising. It is both a celebratory time to talk De La and also an emotionally challenging time to talk De La. As I'm sure y'all know, the first 6 De La albums are now finally available on streaming after many, many years of sample clearance chicaneries and label problems, etc. Also, unfortunately, that comes right on the heels of the passing of Dave Jolisor, True Boy the Dove, a key member of the group. And it's been a really, really challenging stretch of time for De La fans. I will say I was able to go to the thing at the event at Webster Hall a couple nights ago, which was incredibly special. We can get into that a little bit later. But what I wanted to be able to do on Popcast today is really talk about the importance of these records and the kind of incursion that De La Soul really was in those early years. Quest, you want to set the stage a little bit for 3 Feet High and Rising, what hip-hop ecosystem that record was arriving into?
You know, I guess by that point in 1988 really being a critical watershed year for hip-hop coming into its own, a lot of critically acclaimed staples that kind of built the foundation of our lives in hip-hop were created by then. I mean, you're talking Eric B. and Rakim. You're talking about the dense sound of Public Enemy. You're talking, you know, N.W.A., not to mention like things that were 2 years old, like, you know, the Beastie Boys selling 12 million units. MC Light is making material. Like 1988 was such a watershed year with literally the entire, you know, spring and summer of 88, like a classic was being born and really inspiring a generation that's making music right now. But the thing was, it was kind of a monolith, if you can say. There was just kind of a manual step-by-step process that we all followed. And what made De La Soul different was that they kind of went outside of that box. And what happens is that in 88, when I'm listening to this stuff, I mean, I'm just watching from the sidelines, kind of like being at a basketball game, like something that you love to watch, but you yourself never ever would see yourself like
inside
of on the floor playing it. Right. And then suddenly it's the Wizard of Oz moment where it goes from black and white to color, where you suddenly get this idea that, wait, I could do this too. It basically gave nerds a seat at the table in a way that made us cool.
Here's something that I was thinking about. So I spent obviously a lot of time the last couple of days really revisiting the early records in a way that I haven't in a long time. And when I was listening to 3 Feet High, one thing I was trying to think of with the perspective of 30 years of distance is obviously we know it was a hard pivot. We know it was a move in a different direction. We know it was a different sonic approach. We understand it was a different approach when it came to sampling and reference points and attitude and lyrical content. But I was trying to see what lines I could draw, if any, from what De La was doing on 3 Feet High and Rising to anything that had happened in hip hop in the prior 10 years or what it was closest, most analogous to. And I think when I was trying to unravel in that way, it got me really thinking about stuff from the mid to late 70s, the kind of the casualness of how group rhyming was in that era and the kind of interplay and the lightheartedness. Something about that lightheartedness was not quite there in like 84 to 88, but something about the lightheartedness of the, certainly once you get to recorded hip hop, but even like, you know, tapes that you would hear of just old routines from parks and from shows. And I wonder if maybe we could talk a little bit about what threads they were continuing. It wasn't, because it wasn't a totally outsider project. What were the threads that they were actually picking up on?
Okay, so I did some pre-listening, knowing that it was coming out. And I think when Dave died, like I never personally listened to my DJ computer as like background music. Like my DJ computer is my DJ computer. And then my free time away from nightclubbing is other sources of music. But because all those records lived on my DJ computer, this is the first time where I'm like taking my DJ computer with me everywhere just to mourn and listen to it. Because I hear music differently when someone leaves Earth and then you're paying the attention harder. And here's the weird thing. So initially, when the album came out, and this shows you how radical and how much hip hop has changed, a big part of what made 3 Feet High and Rising special was that for a majority of hip hoppers who were sampling heavily between 86 and 89, there was a cheat sheet, if you will, a Wikipedia, a Cliff Notes for hip hop called the Ultimate Beats and Breaks compilation, which, you know, shout out to Break B Lou Flores. And basically it was a 25 volume compilation of the records that, quote, that they were rhyming over back in the day, all the break beats that Grandmaster Flash and Bambaataa and Kool Herc and all that stuff. So, you know, someone got the wise idea to, you know, instead of sending DJs on a mission to find these things, like, we'll put it all in a compilation. And eventually, once we started sampling with Marley Marl and Rick Rubin and whatnot, pretty much all of hip hop took at least 70 to 80% of their output. It's like a different combination of those dishes from Ultimate Beats and Breaks. And what distinguishes the Renaissance period of hip hop, which we call like the De La Soul, Dust Brothers, Tribe Called Quest, like they were taking sound sources from records not on those compilations. So basically you had to do the work. And what was weird to me was, I will say that now that I listen closer, 60% of 3 Feet High and Rising, at least the drum foundation, were from Ultimate Beats and Breaks, but they just found different ways to present it to you. Like Change and Speak still uses the Monkees' Mary Mary as its drum source, of which is on the Ultimate Beats and Breaks. Like Take It Off uses God Made Me Funky by Herbie Hancock's the Headhunters. So they're still using the meat and potatoes foundation of early sampling of hip hop, but it's just done in such a different way. And I think the bottom line is that for a lot of Black artists, the unfortunate effect of Thriller was the monetary effect that it would have on your career. So kind of 82 was a paradigm shift where we had to become achievers because we saw somebody make buku dollars off of their art form. And so I will say that 3 Feet High and Rising, with the exception of like Prince's Dirty Mind, was probably one of the few non-jazz Black pop offerings in which you could tell the artist was doing it from a place of like love and not from a place of, this is going to make me $1 trillion.
Let's get into a little bit more of what the 3 Feet High and Rising sound was like. This is one of the essential songs off that record. This is Potholes in My Lawn.
Now you got the method. What to do when you dive the depth that I predict and plug tuning. It's a shame when you deny to claim that you stole my words of fame that I wrote in my rhyme sheet, which I concentrated so hard on. See, I don't ask for a barbed wire fence, B. My dwelling is swelling.
The radicalness of this record, the intimacy of it, comes down to melodic choices. It comes down to whimsy and humor. It comes down to eccentricity. Joseph, Can you talk a little bit about how 3 Feet High was functioning through those lenses, especially in comparison to what Quest was just talking about, which is everything else that's happening in 88 and almost kind of codified at that point?
Growing up in the suburbs, I loved rap music in high school, but I had no direct connection to it at all. It was me look on the outside looking in. And 3 Feet High and Rising comes out, and it's three teenagers with coded language goofing on each other, which is something that me and my friends could relate to. And it was putting each other down, making fun of each other, but also like talking about girls. And I felt a connection to it based on the subject matter, based on the way they expressed themselves. And it didn't feel distant anymore. It felt very tangible to the life I was living with my friends. And I think that was really, really important for expanding hip hop beyond the audience currently listening to it. Later, sonically, I listened to what 3 Feet High and Rising is doing, and I do feel there is some connection to like what Stetsasonic was doing. Obviously, Prince Paul, Ultra Magnetic MCs, they were slightly askew from what you were hearing elsewhere. But I think that the world building that De La does on 3 Feet High and Rising, they just create this like comic book universe that you can step into that is still relatable, but has this whole different language. Like I was like Buddy and Jennifer. Who's Derwin and who's Jeff, and just the comic book illustrations inside, and just what was Buddy? It sounds dirty.
Right.
Right. Exactly. It just felt like it opened up a portal. Dave Chappelle said this the other night at the event, the De La Soul Experience. He said that De La was the Big Bang. And it's really true. You probably had a lot of kids in their bedrooms rapping and feeling a little unsure of themselves, and then De La comes out and they're like, oh wait, no, I can do this the way I want to do it.
I was those kids.
When 3 Feet High came out, how quickly was it clear, number one, of the ways in which it was different, but did the sort of codified part of the hip-hop world, the part that was already making quote-unquote rap songs with the Ultimate Breaks and Beats compilation in the more conventional accepted fashion, was that world embracing De La, or was that world keeping De La kind of at arm's length and saying, we don't really know what y'all are doing over there?
So let me tell you probably the fastest way I can tell the story. In West Philadelphia, if you look through my life through that lens of, say, like a show like Everybody Hates Chris, that sort of thing, you know, my parents were too protective for me to like allow myself to be that vulnerable to get picked on every day. But let's just say that me stepping outside of the confines of my house was somewhat of a 50-50 risk of running into a bully or some sort of situation. Like I grew up in the crack 80s. I literally probably maybe 4 times in my life, I've seen like the fast effect of how something spreads quickly. And one of the first times where I saw, maybe this is the second time, because, you know, to also watch the Thriller effect was something to behold growing up watching it. But there was two bullies named Chancey and Charles that would terrorize me from like age 10, really till 15 or 16. And I will say that once me, myself, and I got a good maybe 4 weeks on Yo MTV Raps, like suddenly they just looked at me like, oh, you're like those De La Soul kids. Like, you're cool. And they let me go. And I was like, what the hell? Like literally all bullying in my life stopped when that record came out. So that's kind of like why it goes super hard for them, because like to literally have to charter a route to get some bread or toilet paper from the store was like Vietnam levels of safety I had to take. And they made Hard Rocks on the Block be like, oh, okay, you nerds are cool. Because, you know, the thing was, the only person I had that presented any sort of alternative blackness was Prince. And I kind of got really heavy into Prince, like, during the Round the World in a Day parade sound of the times period, in which, you know, Prince was kind of doing his little John Lennon, you know, like, he had graffiti on his Levi's jacket and cuts in his jeans and holes in his jeans. And I was doing that, too. And the kids around my block were like, wait, why would you destroy a good pair of pants like that? And there was no more explanation after De La Soul came out. It was just like, oh, you get a seat at the table.
I'm glad you mentioned Yo MTV Raps, because I do think obviously visuals are so crucial. I mean, it's always crucial in hip hop, but for De La especially, it is a kind of like full immersion experience. You can understand it through the record, but really you want to see the clothes, you want to see the color schemes, you want to see the hairstyles, like you want to see all that stuff. And so it's actually fascinating that when it starts to travel visually, if this had happened pre-Yo MTV Raps, it might not have had the effect as quick as it did, is what you're saying.
Absolutely not, because I mean, UTFO is a good example. They had a member who was supposed to be like the intellectual nerd of the group or whatever. I mean, he dressed up like a nerd. Like back then, it was like the Poindexter sort of look.
Pocket protector, like
right, exactly.
Glasses. And
yeah, it definitely took the visuals to another level. Because one thing is that they dressed in clothes that were like thrift store clothes. And, you know, some that your dad or your mom would wear. And so they just made it cool. They made it look natural. It wasn't contrived looking.
It's also coincides with around college campuses, right? Afrocentricity and, you know, African-American studies programs and all of that's happening on college campuses at the same time, right? I think of Black Medallions, No Gold as a very direct, self-conscious, self-aware statement by the group to say that we are different and we know we're different and we're putting it out there. And I just, you know, remember going through like the hip hop section in a record store and just seeing this album cover and just the color scheme, the aesthetics of it just did not look like anything else in the band. Cause look, there's people who goof in hip hop before, right? You have Biz Markie, you got Prince Paul doing, you know, similar sonic tapestries with Stetsasonic and Ultra Mac, but just De La did it all and did it all very hard left. And I think the UMTV Raps element, right? We used to come home from school and watch videos for 30 minutes. Seeing that video for me, myself, and I, and just being like, oh, they're not trying to look hard. Right. That guy looks like me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that can be understated.
LL Cool J's big tour in 1990, De La's on this tour, but also NWA is on this tour. There's a lot more overlap and intersection between like what 20 years later in the rear view feels like different threads, but there actually was a lot more overlap. Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which those threads in real time were dialoguing with each other?
Here's the funny thing that you mentioned that, because I was just joking with Posse about this maybe like 3 months ago, you know, the whole perception of like, especially that period in the late 80s, like the violence in hip hop and the violence at rap shows and whatnot. And I found out recently that during LL's Nitro tour, which was the tour promoting of the Walking with the Panther albums, like LL, Public Enemy, Eric B. and Rakim, EPMD, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, and De La Soul and Hammer, basically De La Soul was the violent element.
Wait, how so?
Of the tour. Well, because this is the reason why De La Soul's Dead had to get made, because, you know, depending on what city they would go to, they would get tested. And and this is so weird. That night at Webster Hall, I finally got to meet five of the Violators. Like, I've heard of the Violators, and like, I just thought you guys were like some fictional, like invisible, whatever. And I finally meet these guys, these big dudes. And I was like, yo, was that stuff really real about like, you know, you guys having to fight every, like they had to kick De La Soul off the tour because they were too violent, fighting every night in between sets, you know, like going in the audience or whatever. And like, oh, them hippie kids. And they were just getting the fights.
They were just getting pressed constantly, basically.
Yeah. And again, it goes down to me, like they had to fight bullies just so that I could walk to the store to get some bread. Like literally as they're doing this, they're also getting tested, and they were like known as pugilism masters, all the fights they had to get into just to maintain their dignity and self-respect. So it came with a price to pay.
And I do think there's references to that on De La Soul is Dead. Like, I feel like there's at least a couple songs where...
And skits,
absolutely. Yeah.
And I talked to Posse a few times about this. If you really want to see the De La Soul experience, it's almost like Paz will always maintain his witty sense of humor no matter what the band is going through. And there were some few moments where, you know, if you listen to IMIB or some of the introspective songs on like later albums, but you got to watch the sort of evolution of Dave, because literally I just straight up asked Paz, I'm like, wait, so Dave was always like my face or my sort of mirror of what I felt like De La Soul was, but every album he would just sort of get a bigger chip on his shoulder, and to the point where he just sounded like downright angry on the grind date. And, you know, he mellowed out on the Anonymous Nobody, but I would just ask, like, what is that about? And, you know, it's a human experience to watch De La Soul's metamorphosis. It's almost like you have to see Dave's journey from album to album of what it was. And he was just very honest on how he felt. So I can't fault him for that. I know that they took kind of a beating or two. I remember a Spin magazine review of Stakes Is High where they just went out on them. Like, they sound like grumpy old angry men and this ain't the De La Soul I signed up for. And I remember reading that and going back to my own group, like, yo, no matter what we go through, like, we can never talk about like how we really feel, which is sad to say. Like, it's almost like mainstream press only wanted this one-sided, one-dimensional view of what they felt comfortable with us being. And with De La Soul, it was like, okay, well, I think they're happy-go-lucky, so they must stay that forever. And I'm kind of glad they didn't.
Well, let's talk about De La Soul Is Dead a little bit. So obviously, you know, from the album cover with the overturned pot of daisies, one thing you can say about De La is their internal narrative was always fascinating. Like, they're always implicitly responding to the version of themselves that immediately preceded whatever the album was. De La Soul Is Dead is an album, and I'm actually glad you mentioned what happened on that LL tour, because it does sound like an album from a group that had taken lumps and had not quite had like a totally clear path to the carefree enthusiasm that led to the creation of 3 Feet High. In your mind, from a music perspective, what does De La Soul Is Dead achieve that probably couldn't have been anticipated on 3 Feet High?
I actually think De La Soul Is Dead is their magnum opus. I believe that it's funnier than 3 Feet High and Rising. People say like it's a darker record, it's a bitter record, but I actually think that it's funnier and sillier and more in tune to what they were and I was. Part of it, to take the sheet off the whole thing, is that, you know, oftentimes Black artists have to do this code switching thing to make white people feel safe. And I think what they were tired of, what was the code switching, in which the perception of the peace signs and the flowers and all that stuff, like, really it was the art direction and a few photo shoots that really informed what we thought they were. This album, De La Soul Is Dead, is what they actually were, which was funny-ish, but not with that hands-up, don't-shoot approach that most artists have to take in order to not scare white people, which, I mean, basically has been happening since Motown. Like, you know, the reason why Berry Gordy made all those artists go through charm school, and the reason why the Jacksons were so polite, and the reason why we did pop music, and what we say is you don't want to drop the bag or you don't want to mess your money up. But De La Soul Is Dead, to me, was just as innovative sample-wise, production-wise, humor-wise.
Language.
Yeah, it was the best. That, to me, was their best album.
If we're talking about De La Soul Is Dead, we really should talk about one of the absolute masterpieces on this album. Beautiful, vivid songwriting about a very harrowing subject. This is Millie Pulled a Pistol on Santa.
Yeah, it seemed that Santa's ways was parallel with Dilly. But when Millie and him got home, he was more of a villain. While she slept, and he crept inside her bedroom. And he would toss a deal, force her to give him headroom. Millie tried real hard to let this hell not happen. But when she fussed, he would just commence to slap.
In a way, was it a surprise how intensely 3 Feet High and Rising spread to white audiences?
I was a suburban South Asian kid in a pretty mixed society in California. And De La was the first rap group a lot of white kids that I knew liked. I don't know if it was a surprise. I think it was a little bit more genteel for white kids to get into. But going to De La Soul is Dead is like, imagine doing 3 Feet High and Rising and then coming out with your second record 2 years later and being able to still have things to talk about, to do so in a really, really humorous, kind of cynically humorous way, create new characters and create this whole other universe. Like Drez's whole bully character, you know.
Oh, Mr. Long. Yeah.
Yeah. And Hamster Penis. And, you know, just like this whole, like, like a whole entirely new language. Some of the songs are a little cynical towards the music industry, understandably, but done in a really creative way. Like Ring, 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 Ha, Ha, Hey is so funny to me. It's like, I can't imagine what they were going through. And then to make that song is really funny. Biddy's in the BK Lounge. I've never heard anything like it.
My favorite song ever.
Yeah. It's like, to this day, I've never heard anything like it. It's really, really, really funny. It's almost cinematically funny.
I will say this much, though. When you're talking about the surprise element, I think it was more or less a surprise for the artists themselves.
You can put something in the world and think it's going to be received one way and then find it's received an entirely different way. And then that will make you gut check and be like, okay, let's not do that again. I don't want to cultivate that thing that we cultivated.
So the thing is, in the age of the internet, the world is learning all at the same time. And it wasn't until once I studied the hip hop handbook and then looked back in time, I realized that, oh, this happened with rock and roll. And this happened with jazz, and this happened with soul, and this happened with funk, and this happened with disco, and this happened with techno music, which is basically, it has its incubation period, it gives birth, it's an underground movement, and then after its 10th or 15th year, then suddenly it becomes big business, becomes mainstream, and then 30 years, it becomes your parents' music. And I think hip-hop wasn't ready. Like, I remember those Source magazines in which, like, Cypress Hill was getting ridiculed because it was like, wait, where do all these white kids and all these non-black kids show up? Like, these weren't the same kids that were going to the Fresh Fest. And people started placing blame. Like, is this the Beastie Boys' fault? Is this De La Soul? You know, De La Soul and A Tribe Called Quest were both like, nope, not our fault. And here's our regular clothes to prove it. You know, so suddenly, like, we look like you guys, you know? And so nothing is more shameful than to appear to be selling out. So I feel like the last bastion of this conversation before 1997 came and really just threw it out the window, which was like, okay, not only are we going to throw the term selling out, but we're going to make selling out the new norm. So having or quote unquote integrity is going to be like the foreign thing. And yeah, I think that it was jarring for these audiences, because even for the Roots, like, there was conversations of like, okay, well, like, when's our, like, slow motion Hype Williams video? Like, where's our bottle of champagne that we're going to pour on girls? Like, when's that going to happen? Like, why are these, like, white dudes with glasses chasing me to my car? Like, we're the real groupies at, like, and we learned that that was never going to happen. So for those few acts, those Arrested Developments, those Diggable Planets, those pre-1994 groups, there was somewhat of a slight dismay or a jarring sense of like rejection that your audience doesn't look like you do. I think they looked at it as glass half empty, as in the black audience is ignoring us. Now we're babysitting all these other people that expect us to be representatives of the culture. And by the time the Roots came along, I think we were just so happy to get a seat at the table. It's like, okay, well, hey, a sold out audience is a sold out audience. So cool.
But it's worth mentioning at this particular time, Young TV Raps era, the growth of hip hop radio, hip hop specific radio, what's happening is the audience is not the audience that it was in 1985 or 1986. The audience is much vaster. And then not just in terms of diversity, but just sheer numbers. And there are more types of people showing up, creating a broader palette of taste, and therefore creating space for groups and acts doing all different kinds of things. And that's not really what was on the table in like 1984 to 1986. Let's listen to Biddy's in the BK Lounge, and we'll be right back.
Excuse me, would you take my order? I have the go. Shoshana's got a real job, Dag, don't you know?
Yeah, it's you. Now I recognize the real, real bitty with the fake, fake eyes. Hey. Yo, can I interest you in some burgers and fries?
Yes, you can, but you can keep your lies. Cause you know you can't diss me, but you pissing me off.
What are you talking
I know
about?
Where you live and I know that you're soft. You're, right. You're as booty as they come and you dress like a geek. My shoes cost more.
This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover-Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. Questlove's here. Jazzbo's here. Sorry, I'm going to keep doing it to you for the duration of the episode. I love you, though.
I still call him Jazzbo, too. Yeah.
That's great. Phenomenal.
Not Oscar-winning Joseph Patel, but Jazzbo.
That's fine. Always Jazzbo in our hearts. Let's talk about that, what we were just discussing about the broadening of the hip-hop audience. Because, Quest, what you were saying a little bit about the roots, I think is really telling that at a certain point, you go out and there is an audience there. And like, that's gratifying on its own terms, separate from the conversation of who's in that crowd. Do you think that De La, because they kind of had to forge that territory and kind of carve out the space first, it was a more conflicted thing for the group?
They're the pioneers, and then there's the second wave. And when you're a pioneer, you're too busy on your knees laying down the red carpet and cleaning the place up so that the second wave can walk through and reap the benefits. And it's weird that in De La's case, they were the wave that reaped the benefits of the previous school, that second wave, that Run DMC wave, that Beastie Boys wave, that Public Enemy wave. But, you know, they wound up laying the red carpet that will eventually be the lane that your Roots, your Commons, your Mos Defs, even down to your Kanye Wests getting royal treatment. But, you know, they kind of had to sacrifice themselves. Like, I think no group in hip hop has pioneered more things more than De La Soul. Any sample that they've used, any rhyming concept that they've used, any video idea that they've used. I mean, I alone probably took count that the Roots have done at least 18 blatant De La Soul ideas and one with at least four of them, you know. And it's just, well, I mean, the thing was, when the Roots started, we were kind of we didn't have songs. We just went on the street corner and busked. And at the time, it's sort of like, what music we do? Let's do a ring, 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 ha, ha. We would do Stone Age so much on the street corners for our 4-hour repertoire, in which we had no songs, that eventually that was just going to rub off on our records. And so it was like, I don't have an idea. What song do I do? I don't know. Do the De La Soul thing. And that's how, like, even the Roots' very first single, Distortion of Static, got made, because we were always doing Stone Age and our freestyle, you know, stuff. The pioneer never, ever truly gets the just desserts. I'll say, fortunately for them, they've maintained a straight ahead approach and not get sidetracked like a lot of other hip hop groups that could either just mire themselves in bitterness and fallen by the waysides.
I always found it fascinating. De La Soul seemed to be really uncomfortable
with their success from an outsider perspective. Because in some respects, they weren't successful. They weren't like pushing a million records. I think they did long for sort of more Black acceptance or more conventional hip hop acceptance. I saw De La twice in 91. The first time was in San Francisco. The second time was this incredible show in San Jose in a room for 75 people or 100 people with Leaders of the New School, Brand Nubian, and KMD.
Dang.
And it got shut down by the police because
what?
The promoter was some like like college freshman promoter and didn't, and the cops ended up shutting it down like three songs in a De La set. But I think it was 91, if not, it was 92, where De La is already doing 3 feet High and Rising and saying, I hate the song. I hate this song. Right. Yep. And that was part of their thing. It's so they really seem to struggle with where they fit in the scheme of things. You see it reflected both in De La Soul's Dead and in Ballooned Mind State, and then even more pronounced in Stakes Is High. I think they have every right to feel that way. I think it felt like three people who were sometimes felt free and sometimes didn't. And
you think they felt guilty for the success?
I think they felt a little, not guilty. I think they just felt like they wanted a different type of success than they were getting. And I think this speaks to a lot of what you were saying. Sometimes a sold out show is a sold out show. It doesn't matter who's in the audience. But truthfully, right, it does matter to you who's in the audience.
I will say that, yes, our last show in San Francisco, I was legit shocked by song number two. I actually said in the Roots microphone, like, yo, I never seen this many Black people in the audience. Like, we were legit happy because, like, that's always been the issue with us. Like, damn, how much funkier can we get? Like, how much culture can we bring to the table and still get ignored like that? And yeah, I actually found myself celebrating like, yo, all right, Black people are still with us. That meant something to me.
Also, just an aside, because I still am such a fanboy for Amir and the Roots, but after that San Francisco show, Amir did a 4-hour De La Soul DJ set. And I thought you were gonna just do like the first hour as a tribute to De La.
Nah.
But you went like full 4 hours of De La, and it was incredible. It was De La versus De La songs, obscure things, sample sources, different flips of De La song. It was just an incredible presentation of how deep and rich that catalog is, even just beyond the surface releases. So yeah, that was a lot of fun for me.
Thank you. The thing that you were talking about the We Hate This Song moment, We Hate This Song when they play Me, Myself, and I, my We Hate This Song moment is, and I think it's revealing in the context of what we're talking about in terms of audiences, it's probably 93 or 94. It's at Wellesley College in like semi-suburban Massachusetts and in the auditorium at Wellesley. I had not seen De La before. And, you know, as a fan, I was like, what? You hate this song? And then immediately I was like, oh, I get it. Like, of course. It's the only song 90% of the people in this room know. And that, I imagine, that's horrific. And I'm sure horrific for any artist that is a serious album-oriented or craft-oriented artist to know that they are being judged or shaped by one song that they're maybe not even that partial to. But I also think, when you think of the music that was being made, so we're talking, if it was 94, this is right after Ballooned Mind State and before Stakes Is High. To me, Ballooned Mind State and Stakes Is High are two complementary refusenik statements about what had happened with De La Soul. And as De La Soul was finding its place in the emerging broadening of the hip hop audience, other parts of hip hop were moving in totally different directions. And certainly by the time Stakes Is High, you know, we're fully in the Bad Boy era. And to me, Ballooned Mind State seems like a very insular, like we're in our heads kind of record. And Stakes Is High is very much like our eyes are wide open. We see everything y'all are doing. It's frustrating us. We're upset. And we're kind of aware that we're on the outside of this, but we can still make a record that absolutely slaps.
I think Ballooned Mind State was De La Soul's dealing with themselves. And then Stakes Is High was them dealing with hip hop as a culture. I'm about to make it like a movie. Like, you remember in the Bible when Jesus went up to the merchants and destroyed the temple? Stakes Is High was kind of their ritual burning of the temple. In 96, there was a kind of rude awakening in which we realized that like a lot of this hip hop wasn't going to be trickle down information, and that once every 5 years, you would have to remind the new person that was between the age of 15 and 23, who you were. And the fact that you could be ancient after 5 years or 10 years is ludicrous. But back to Balloon Mind State, if you listen to In Focus, one of the cool things about De La is their structured wordplay and the confusion of it all. To listen to all of In Focus, I couldn't exactly tell you what that song is about, but it's almost like me listening to the Jamaican part of my family talk. Like, I can take out keywords and figure out what it means.
You know what they're talking about, even if you don't know what they're saying.
Yeah, and literally, if you listen to In Focus, it's a song about, hey, we released this song called Me, Myself, and I, and the whole world loved us. And the second that that song, because Pasta News basically says that when the knee went deeper and deeper off the chart, meaning not just knee deep, the Funkadelic song that gave him Me, Myself, and I, then the album faded to black, in which he's talking about, like, now Black Sheep is the new darlings of the native tongue world. That's when the amnesia starts. Chukwuoyi talks about he becomes a star and Love and Deluxe, you won't catch me in no tux. Like, basically, there's a tab at the bar, you get in the club for free, everyone loves you. And the second that you don't have a hit song, then you get thrown away. Really, In Focus is the song that lets you know how De La Soul felt, which was basically, we released one song that we didn't really want to do that you guys accepted. And then suddenly you're trying to dispose of us and ignore us and kick us out. And that to me was the real De La Soul is Dead record. I always wonder when people are like, man, Balloon Mind State is my favorite De La record. I'm like, but, you know, even though there was humor on it, it was a sad, melancholy album.
It's a self-immolation. It's a self-immolation record.
Right. And then to have A Tribe Called Quest come like 2 months later and release Midnight Marauders almost proved it right. Like, oh man, I forgot about Balloon Mind State because all I'm listening to is Midnight Marauders. And it took time for me to really accept that record as part of their genius streak. But at the time when it came out, I had like bitter conflicts about it. I guess I too was one of the people that was putting pressure on them to keep me happy by looking happy all the time.
Let's listen to one of the really emblematic songs on Balloon Mind State. This is I Am IB.
The pile of revenue I create, but I guess I don't get a cut because my rent's a month late. The deeds of a natural are seeds that are no longer planted, so the famine in the mind is strong. Tactics of another plane is now proven sane. Sane enough to let you know from within this song. I stabilize me.
I think Balloon Mind State was something that I don't know that we had seen in hip hop before, especially in that moment. So we're talking 93, right? So not only are you talking Midnight Marauders, but also you're talking Biggie, you're talking Wu-Tang, you're talking the beginning of what we now understand as like the full pop crossover moments of hip hop, broadly speaking. Ambition, the desire for success, like all of these things were suddenly on the table. These opportunities were beginning to be on the table that were not really on the table in the 80s. And Balloon Mind State is an album that's in direct emotional conflict, not only with what the group had become, but what with everything else that was going on. And I don't think we'd seen something like that in hip hop before. I mean, I'm sure you can identify underground or backpack records later in the 90s that touch on this. And certainly by now, there's all different kinds of refusenik microtributaries of the genre. But at that time, it really felt like a one of one. And I think, Quest, to your point, when Marauders comes around saying, no, we're playing the game. Like we're here. We want to do it and we want to do it as big and as elegantly as possible. This idea, it did make Balloon feel even smaller, even if it was designed to be a little bit of a insular record. It felt even more so in the wake of everything else that happened later that year.
I remember my A&R, Wendy Goldstein, telling me, whatever you guys do, like, we'll give you carte blanche, but please don't do any complaints about the sad state of the music industry because no one cares about that. No one cares. No, seriously. And that's the difference between Marauders and Stakes Is High was that De La Soul allowed you into what they were feeling. Whereas it wasn't necessarily that on Marauders, you know, not to mention just the sonic and music choices of Marauders just you know, I'm not just saying like, oh, it's the better of the two. Like Marauders might be like one of my moments in life, period. Like I put it up with any loved record, but I forgot to mention that when Dr. Dre's The Chronic comes out, before that pivotal moment in which all the stars are aligned, like MTV's playing hip hop and all those things, here comes an album from Dr. Dre, which musically sounds like FM radio. Like it's the total antithesis of the whole basement, grimy, do it yourself in your bedroom, you know, like the Jungle Brothers album, like just the janky sound. And it sounds so clear, so masterful. And also it goes so extreme on the kind of caricatures of what non-Black people thought that Black people were. Like, oh, I now get to see the gangster lifestyle without having to get to know Black people. And on top of that, I mean, Snoop is just a charismatic motherfucker. Like, he has one of the best voices ever. And, you know, just all the stars were aligned. And as a result, here's the first time that something truly, quote unquote, real hip hop gets mainstream love. And as a result, everyone looked at Chronic as the blueprint and all the rules were thrown out the window. So thus, Ready to Die was just an East Coast Chronic. And once that happened, then everyone, Nas, everyone was just like, well, I want my piece of the pie too. And suddenly the rule books were thrown out the window and it was another Thriller moment. It became quantity, not the quality, but the quantity of it all. How much can I sell? How much can I make? And so I'll say that maybe Balloon Mind State was the post-Chronic effect, but Stakes Is High was the post-Chronic effect of hip-hop reactionary.
Stakes Is High obviously comes out the same year as Reasonable Doubt. It's interesting to listen to these two albums kind of in tandem with each other, because Stakes Is High is sort of like inveighing against this thing that the genre has become. But then you listen to something like Reasonable Doubt and you're like, it's still pretty beautiful and artful. And, you know, it's obviously it's more commercially oriented. It has grander, quote unquote, ambitions. But all the things that we loved in 1982 or 1988, like they're all still here. So that's where like the light kind of like crotchetiness of Stakes Is High, as much as I love this album, I always felt like it maybe wasn't exactly listening with open ears to everything that was happening around. It was much more skeptical than I think it probably needed to be.
I think we all feel that way about Stakes Is High because of the song Stakes Is High. The rest of that album actually bangs. Like it's got some real interesting, really cool, like pure hip hop joints on it. So it's funny because I think that song is so good and that song is almost like a knife in how pessimistic it feels. But the rest of the album is really like almost like a club hip hop record.
So you're saying that our perception of the song Stakes Is High was almost, I always said that with Commons, I Used to Love Her. Like people put Phrase on the Resurrection album when they really just meant
the song.
The song I Used to Love Her. Yeah. Somehow like Resurrection, the album became like lumped in with it. So yeah, Stakes Is High, the song is what people are feeling. And then
yeah,
it gets lumped in.
Because even the Stakes Is High remix is a more upbeat sort of thing. Like Stakes Is High is such a great term.
Right.
Shout out Eric Johnson, also who photographed the cover. But like, you know, I'm looking at Super MCs, The Business, Once Again Long Island. Like these are good hip hop records. It's So Easy. Like these are really good hip hop records. They're not cynical, but the song Stakes Is High.
It's So Easy might be cynical.
And It's So Easy might be cynical. And it's actually.
But there's a food fight in the video. Yeah, so right. That sort of takes our mind off.
And it's such a like breezy little beat. So like that tension is really good. But yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I think, but Stakes Is High. I think you listen to that song now, like 25 years later, that song is still so good. It is still.
And it was needed.
Needed. And it's still needed.
But there's a rule that Black people can't criticize each other in public. So that was like the real issue with it. Like, okay, like we're not supposed to say in front of company how we feel about each other. So that was unheard of in 1996. Like you had to code your diss, not like, I'm sick of Versace glasses. Like,
who could that be?
We're talking about Stakes Is High. This is Stakes Is High, and you'll understand what kind of emotional and philosophical territory we're getting into.
High, high, high. You know them stakes is high. We talking about high, high, high.
Joseph, though, was some of the cynicism sublimated on this album? Like, obviously, Stakes is High, the song, is very literal and very direct. But the thing that De La did on this record that I think is so fundamentally different from the first three albums, to me, the songs, the production is much more literal. And to me, that inherently was a cynical decision to say, hey, we can do these kinds of songs also. Yeah, maybe on one or two songs, we're saying what we feel. But actually, on most of this album, we're communicating the kind of like, yeah, casual disdain, and also we can get it in just like everybody else. Is it, to me, it's being coded in the production. It's being coded in the fact that Stakes is High is doesn't have the kind of like pure eccentricity of a De La Soul is Dead or 3 Feet High is Rising. It came to play, and that to me is low key, lightly cynical.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're not working with Prince Paul. And I remember at the time it was like, you know, it's all we talked about. It's like, oh, was there beef between Prince Paul and De La? And it's like, I'm sure that run of albums for them just felt like it had sort of exhausted itself. They bring in Dilla, working with Dilla for the first time. I guess there is a little cynicism in it, but I don't really read that as being cynical. Maybe it is, because I think De La is always constantly assessing where they fit in the landscape.
Yeah, it's meta-narrative always.
Yeah. Also, I just think that, you know, look, De La's a group, again, that they like to have a good time. Mace will tell you that, you know, he still knows how to DJ a club. And I think there's elements of that on Stakes is High, I think, more than we give it credit for. And I don't know if it's a cynical decision to say, hey, we can make these songs too. It could be. Sometimes just, you know, enjoy it for what it is.
I think they also grew to the point where they wanted to express themselves as musicians as well. Because Paul told me, I think the only song, like Paul started Stakes is High, and then after 3 weeks, then it was sort of like, okay, let me phase out. So I believe that he told me, like, I guess like the dog barking on Dog Eat Dog was like Paul's like main contribution, like that thing, which if you listen to the intro, that's clearly a Prince Paul like moment, having a barking dog, you know, while the keyboards of Dog Eat Dog starts. But yeah, but for a lot of it, like Merce and Dave were like, okay, we have ideas, and Mace too, we have ideas that we want to implement and utilize. And I think it was time for them to take the training wheels off and let them do it. And I think Paul was really classy about letting them ride off into the sunset and become their own person.
Before we go, we're going to unfortunately skip over all the later records, but, you know, we obviously Artificial Intelligence, Mosaic, Something Bionics, Grind Date, Anonymous Nobody. But I want to talk a little bit about this sort of like 89 to the Chronic moment, right? And what was allowed to blossom as a result of what De La did. Can we talk about what happened during those 4 years, and maybe more pointedly, what did that set the table for now in the 2010s and the 2020s?
You know, it's weird. Dr. Dre actually goes on record to say that the album that allowed him to make the Chronic was 3 Feet High.
Really? Rising. Do you say that?
Well, because Bill Hader put it the best. Bill Hader told me that listening to 3 Feet High and Rising was like, for him, a Monty Python Fawlty Towers moment, where just the level of humor that they have and the inside humor of it all. And if you look at it through that lens, like, I looked at it as like the cool kids in school that always had inside jokes that I wish I was in up on. What's a cracker? What's those things? And it's sort of that way with the Chronic. Like, suddenly, like, we're hearing them joke with each other, and like, now we're having these nuts and all these other like inside jokes that were on the Chronic as well. They invented the skit. They invented the overbloated album production. Oh, we get 25 songs on this thing? Like, short songs, you know, crazy interludes, like everything was up in the air. So yeah, I think even to this day, like, you know, you're looking at MF Doom records, you're looking at even with Slum, but you know, Slum Village isn't as championed in the mainstream. I guess it gets filtered through Dilla's death, but a lot of their records, like there's a hell of a lot of influence on the after effect of 3 Feet High and Rising. And for me, the most important effect is that the greatest takeaway we can take away from it is, wow, they actually own their masters. So this actually gives me hope. There was a a brief second where we had like a group meeting 3 years ago, like, hey, should we go to Universal and ask for our 17 records back and And nah, that'll never happen. But no.
And that's a new development. We should just, for folks who don't know, De La was on Tommy Boy Records, which was bought and sold a couple times. And the company that currently owns Tommy Boy reverted the rights of the masters back to De La, sort of in anticipation of this sample cleared reissue campaign.
There is a part two to this conversation, because I think De La Soul has been almost the most mistreated group in the industry. What they did on 3 Feet High and Rising, this it's great that we're celebrating them arriving on streaming this week, but it feels like these records should have been allowed to have been cleared many years ago. It's a weird situation when you're living 25 years later based on a contract you signed when you were 18 years old and being held to that. Like they've been fighting this fight for a long time, to the point where 10 years ago, right, they released their MP3s of their albums for free in protest of the situation they were in. And the fact that certain people in their camp worked really hard to get these records on streaming should not go ignored, especially the folks at Reservoir for giving them the masters back. But just, it should never have come to that in the first place, which is maybe another episode you'll do at some other point. But one thing I do want to say about some of the offspring of De La's success, I think, frames Tribe's success, even though Tribe was going to come out anyway. You know, it allows Leaders of the New School, which gives us Busta Rhymes. It allows KMD. It allows Brand Nubian. It allows groups in different cities to come out. You don't get Arrested Development, right, without De La. You don't get MF Doom without KMD. You know, Stone's Throw and Madlib and Mos Def and Talib Kweli and Raucous Records, all that is all a byproduct of De La. So, like, you know, just to bring it full circle, like when Dave Chappelle says De La was the Big Bang in a lot of ways, like, he's right. It really was the Big Bang, both for listeners, for other artists, and for labels to put out those artists.
And also on top of that, you don't get Pharrell and the Neptunes without Native Tongues. And by extension, you don't get Tyler and you don't get Odd Future and you don't get that generation. Like, to me, early Odd Future always reminded me a lot of early De La, in the sense that it was a closed circle of reference points, interesting musical touchstones, humor, wit, eccentricity, little extreme moments that you're kind of like, what? That just came out of nowhere.
Anyone an oddball, anyone a nerd, anyone a dweeb or a geek, like, that's pretty much it.
Questo, Jazzbo, a joy.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Before we go, I do want to talk briefly about the event at Webster Hall a couple nights ago. First of all, to be in a room full of such unreconstructed joy, pure happiness, it doesn't happen that much. It certainly doesn't happen to me that much. It was a beautiful thing to see. It was also very much class reunion vibes. Literally, you just cannot walk 10 feet without bumping into somebody that you used to see at shows in the 90s. It was just an incredible energy. It was so encouraging to be here in 2023 and be able to have access to the same kind of pure enthusiasm and exuberance that being a De La fan in the late 80s and 90s allowed access to. It was really, really special. So many friends. Shout out all my old 360 Hip Hop coworkers that were in the building, all the writers, all my friends, some of my enemies. Y'all stay cute, but, you know, it's great to see y'all too. But just like a really, really, really beautiful room, and allowed me to feel tapped in to a happiness that really felt buried somewhere. And maybe it was buried because of 25 years of professional music industry stuff, or buried because the music moved in a different direction and I moved with it. But it was really encouraging to know that that was still there inside me, and from what I can see in that room, inside everybody else as well. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get the t-shirts. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple, et cetera, Email us podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord/podcast Facebook. Our producer, as always, and here we are on a Saturday. It's Pedro Rosado from Mad Stubber Media. We'll be back next week. Let's go out. It's Saturday. It's not quite a roller skating jam here Saturday, but spiritually, It's a roller skating jam named Saturdays. De La Soul, Q-Tip, Vinnie Mojica. Back next week.
Girl meets boy on Thursday night. Boy was high, girl fly like kite. They hold hands until next day. Boy then let's go hit his way. Boy rolls butt rack to his boy. Erection brings bad boy joys. Boy thinks of that big fat fat. Big black fat, love big black fat. Girl calls boy to send him up on Saturday. Saturday, Saturday is the Saturday.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.